My talk tonight is about what the precepts promise. In my email this week introducing the talk, I said that I was raised the idea of sin and hell. So the idea of the precepts didn't appeal to me very much at first as something that would make me feel good. I thought that they were about what I should or should not do, and there was always this idea that I was going to somehow fall short of being the person I should be. And that's really not what the precepts are about at all. They are like guide ropes to help us find our way through the caves of life. There are five of them for lay people. The first is to avoid physically harming other beings. Specifically, traditionally, it says killing. But any violence, any physical violence, we do violence not just to another being, but to ourselves. And the second precept is to avoid taking what isn't freely given. The third is to stay away from misusing sexual energy. The fourth is watching out for harmful speech. And the fifth is beware the demon rum intoxicants. So I want to say right at the beginning that this talk is very much inspired by a series of articles that Gil Fronsdell published in the Insight Meditation Center newsletter over a period of about a year and a half. Now, as I personally have worked with the precepts, I have found a real sense of being relieved of many of the mental and emotional burdens that I was carrying around. And this relief is like having something, this burden, lifted. So, in a sense, many senses, the precepts are a way to enlightenment. Traditionally, the precepts are taken by saying, I undertake the training to. And then you say each of the precepts. And it is a training. It's a practice. Just like the mind training of mindfulness meditation or concentration. So this isn't a standard of conduct that we have to meet in order to be a good person or to get some award. People are going to be judging us, of course, all the time, but probably not for how well we live up to the precepts. What we are when we practice the precepts is being a person who finds happiness through activities that are intended to benefit all beings, ourselves as well as others. So it's a win-win-win proposition. And I'd like to go into each of these five lay precepts and talk about how they are liberating. The first one, this avoiding physically harming others, goes right to the heart of the Eightfold Path and of Buddhist ethics, this principle of non-harming. I talked about it a couple of weeks ago with the practice of kindness. I'm coming back to that principle here in talking about the precepts because they too are totally based on this idea of being kind and avoiding harming others. This is the gateway to a clear conscience and to what's traditionally called the bliss of blamelessness. It's being able to, you know, go to sleep at night knowing that we need not be ashamed of anything we've done that day. It's a wonderful feeling. As with the law of karma, the first precept is rooted in the intention with which we act in this world. They both turn on intention. Is our conduct inspired by kindness or driven by anger or greed or jealousy or just mindless confusion? All aspects of the Eightfold Path come together in this fundamental guidance to honor and act on intentions that are kind and refrain from acting in ways that might cause harm. So it's not pious altruism. Avoiding harm includes not harming yourself. A Zen teacher of mine compared living by the precepts to the way elephants move in this world, quite intentionally, placing those massive feet with great care. It safeguards them, their family, and their environment. This isn't to say they won't uproot a tree if, you know, there's something edible on it. They have tremendous power. And it may seem strange to think of yourself as powerful as an elephant. But you are. Living in this high-tech society gives us similar and actually much greater capacity to have an impact on the world, for good or ill. Within the past couple of weeks, I was saying metta and thinking, may all beings feel peaceful and happy, patient and kind, taking care of themselves and each other lovingly. And at about this time, chills started running through my body as I contemplated what that would mean. What if we all took care of ourselves and each other lovingly? Truly feeling patient and kind. Wouldn't you want to live in that Garden of Eden? Mm-hmm. So this is the freedom that's offered by the precepts. To feel safe and secure. To engage with all beings without an undertow of mistrust or ill will. We achieve this by being mindful of our own psyches. What is our intention when we do this or that? Knowing this takes practice at looking inward through meditation, and it takes a pervasive attitude of acceptance of what we see when we do look inside our hearts and our minds. We must see ourselves clearly in order to eliminate states of mind that cause harm to ourselves and to others. Without this kind of insight, trying to aim our behavior toward peace and kindness would be like a surgeon operating with their eyes closed. We need to know what we're thinking, what our intentions are. And to do this, all it takes is the confidence to be honest and to watch how our minds are trying to make us act. putting this sometimes subconscious pressure on us to behave in a way that really isn't to our own benefit. The second precept is to take what isn't freely given. And I really like this phrasing of it. Sometimes people abbreviate it to say, not stealing. But if we limit our taking to what's freely given, then there's this sense of gratitude that comes with everything that we gather unto ourselves. Because we know there's at least some part of it that's a gift. We haven't deprived anyone of anything that they would begrudge us for. And we know we haven't caused any pain in depriving other people of something that was of value to them. The second precept helps us recognize that, as Gill puts it, our greatest wealth is in our hearts. This is a powerful recognition that our happiness emanates from our intention. Our intention to be kind, rather than our happiness coming from anything material. It's an inside job. We generate our happiness through the nature of our intention toward ourselves and the world around us. Now, there are a whole lot of people who simply do not steal. So, phrasing this precept as not taking anything that isn't freely given broadens it to be practiced by such people on a more subtle level. Like being aware of who labored under what conditions to make the things that we buy. Is buying a pair of cheap tennis shoes at the expense of someone who worked in a sweatshop? What were the materials used in what we're buying, and how were they acquired? Were natural resources or people exploited in the process? So taking only what is freely given all the way through the economic process that puts things into our possession can bring us into harmony with the whole world in which we live. Now, it could make your average trip to Target kind of slow because you're reading all the labels, you're trying to see if you remember where this comes from, who's got sweatshops. Within reasonable boundaries, just staying aware of this gift of things being freely given, a transaction that is voluntary on the part of everyone concerned, really opens us up to that bliss of blamelessness. The third precept is to avoid misusing sexual energy. And with this precept also, I think of it as broader than behavior that's explicitly sexual. There are plenty of snares in the underbrush of life that are set by flirting in varying degrees of obviousness. Sometimes even that unspoken, unacted vibe of interest can be enough to make us take a U-turn toward consequences that aren't good. When we're under the influence of sexual energy that's misguided, it can feel like a stinging rash. and it makes us unable to resist impulses that we know are bad for us and for others. And we can increase the power of this almost state of insanity if we engage in fantasies about conduct that we know would be harmful. And it puts us at risk of losing control. So that's what I mean by abusing sexual energy. It feels good at first, you know, to have this nice little daydream about, you know, but there's a price for it. So it's good to look, again, just like with things freely given, to look at the broadest boundaries of the situation. To consider what are the intentions, expectations, and commitments of everyone involved. There could be promises made that we're not aware of. Well, have we asked? When just a gesture could mean something very different to the other person than it does to us, we need to tread carefully. Because without being aware or thinking about the other person's vulnerabilities, we could cause them heartache, we could disappoint them and leave them feeling betrayed and resentful. Gil Fronsdale says, because the sexual drive can be strong enough to override a person's wisdom, compassion, and common sense, help is sometimes needed to avoid engaging in inappropriate sexual behavior. The third precept is such a safeguard from unexamined, impulsive behavior. So the formula is to just spend some time thinking about this precept and all of them, and staying tuned to the influence that sexual energy has over us. And when we do this, we're able to construct kind of an internal warning system to let us know any time that our sexual behavior is motivated by something other than goodwill and compassion. And when we have that early warning system, it brings an ease into our intimate relationships, as well as to our friendships and our passing acquaintances. It gives us a chance to stay in control of our lives and literally not to hurt those we love. We can be free to choose which desires to act on and free from overwhelming desires. The fourth precept is wise. Like all of the precepts, but clearly in particular, this one is based on honesty. Unwise speech, I can visualize it as like cement. It just pours out freely, and then it solidifies into this distorted and unwise understanding. When we engage in speech that isn't wise, it's like we're setting up a maze that we will have to navigate to get back to the freedom of just being clear and open in what we say. It was terrifying to me when I first started practicing wise speech. I had lived in this kind of labyrinth of lies for so long that all of those little and some very big lies, it felt to me like they were holding me together. I depended on them. I maintained them like garden plants, this hodgepodge world that I had constructed would somehow hold together. But they weren't really holding me together. They were just binding me really tightly. When I made the decision, set the intention to speak only truth, it was like finally having those chains lifted off. It was so much easier to just tell the truth than to try to remember the lies that I had been telling. At the beginning was the painful part, when I had to own up to these deceits that I'd been carrying on. And there were a few people who refused to forgive me. A large percentage didn't know or care, and a whole lot had known all along that I wasn't being truthful. They just weren't letting on. Once I had cleared the field of broken truth, it became so simple and easy to just say what I knew to be true. It was much easier to remember. So living according to the truth supports whatever peace we gain through our practice. Untruths come out of mind states that are uncomfortable, and they lock those mind states into our psyches like hardened cement. So here's an unpleasant state of mind. It causes us to depart from the truth in our speech, and then it perpetuates that unpleasant state of mind. And this is true also of speech that isn't kind, helpful, or appropriate. So those are the other three corollaries of wise speech. That it be truthful, helpful, kind, and appropriate. And again, these are guidelines. True words can be hurtful. No matter how totally true it is, when we know or even sense that someone would be hurt or upset by something that we know to be true, it's probably best that we refrain from saying it. We can do much more good if we wait until we sense that the listener is able to hear and use the information in a way that's helpful to them. I recently had a conversation in which a friend was telling me about recognizing this troublesome habit that a mutual acquaintance of ours has. It had been over a year that I had been kind of biting my tongue, not telling this friend about this person and this habit, because it had never really appeared that my friend wanted to know what it was I wanted to say. In other words, if I had talked about this third person, it would have been gossip. It would have been coming from a motivation of relieving my irritation about this person's habits. But in this conversation, my friend made it clear that my advice would be welcome. And so I made a very carefully worded suggestion. And then I started another sentence. But I felt that old twinge of resentment about the trouble that it caused by this person's tendency to do this thing. And I knew that what I was about to say was not motivated by kindness, but by my desire to validate my feelings of resentment. And those feelings are a burden to me. They're not comfortable. And to express them with this intention would have given them more energy to continue troubling me. And I knew that if I resisted expressing them that way, they wouldn't get fed and they would continue to shrink. The fifth precept. Buddha said that consuming intoxicating substances can lead to loss of wealth, increased quarreling, susceptibility to illness, disrepute, and a weakening of wisdom. Nailed it. All of this. Yeah. So that's 2,500 years ago, and everybody knew this is what happened when people habitually get drunk, or I don't know what other intoxicants were around then, but I'm sure they had them. Gill says that what's modern is the incredibly wide range of addicting substances and unwholesome pleasures that are so readily available now. They're so easy to obtain that parents have to start really keeping an eye on their kids at about age 10, if not before. So whether it's through substances or harmful behaviors that take us away from mindfulness, intoxication robs us of our freedom. For an alcoholic or an addict, it's as if they're handing the keys to their life over to the substance that they're ingesting. Their bodies may still act in this world, but they're accumulating consequences by conduct that that person has no control over. The addictive gambler or shopper or kleptomaniac or sex addict or gossiper or rageaholic also knows the feeling of enslavement to what at first felt like a pleasurable or relaxing diversion, like a glass of wine in the evening. But then, maybe quickly, maybe gradually, it took over with often disastrous consequences. So the fifth precept points us toward being not just mindful, but rigorously honest with ourselves. For people in recovery from addiction, this is a key factor in staying clean and sober. As human beings, just surrounded by opportunities for addiction, I mean, look at how addicted people get to their phones. Being honest with ourselves about what enslaves our minds and hearts is key to staying free. We may not know at first that that glass of wine in the evening is being poured in an increasingly large glass, or that there are three glasses of wine in the evening. But if we stay honest and we stay observant, we can back away before any behavior starts to take us away from control over our own lives. There is no cheating on this kind of loss of control. Either we are free or we're not, moment by moment. Addictive behavior doesn't have to end up in the gutter to rob us of our mental and emotional well-being, any more than we have to be murderers, thieves, adulterers, or compulsive liars to be unhappy. When it is no longer tied down by actions that are intended to harm any beings, that's when the heart is free to soar. Thank you.